So we're going to discuss the management commentary. I'll give the floor to Julia.
Thank you very much, Hans. Good morning, everyone. So I will start with a brief introduction of where we are in the project and next steps, and then we'll turn over to Yelena to introduce the first paper for this meeting. So earlier this year, the board discussed disclosure objectives and supporting guidance on all areas of content in management commentary. Following those discussions and considering the comments made by the board, we have been working on the drafting, and we sought further feedback on our working draft, both from the board and from Management Commentary Consultative Group, as discussed in Agenda Paper 15A. In September, the board discussed the status of the practice statement, the statements of compliance, and procedures for issuing management commentary. At this meeting, we would like to present an overview of the proposed guidance on topics of particular interest to stakeholders, long-term prospects, ESG matters, and intangibles. We will also discuss the likely effects of the proposed revised practice statement, and we also plan to discuss due process steps undertaken in the project and ask the board for permission to begin the balloting process. We are not asking the board for a decision on the comment period at this meeting, but we invite your comments. We plan to ask for a decision on the comment period at a future meeting as drafting progresses. Finally, on Tuesday this week, the board discussed stakeholder feedback on timing of the board's forthcoming consultations and whether and what adjustments are needed to project timelines to address stakeholder feedback. In particular, the board discussed the deferral of the publication date of the forthcoming exposure draft on management commentary from February 2021 to May 2021. Considering the comments from the board at that meeting and also considering stakeholder feedback discussed by the board at that meeting, the staff plan to work towards issuing the exposure draft in April 2021. So this is looking at our holistic timetable, and we think that this would help address stakeholder concerns about timing of overlapping consultations and also continuing challenges presented by COVID-19, while also maintaining the momentum in this project. With that, unless there are any questions for me, I will hand it over to Yelena.
Yelena?
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. So today we'll be starting with Agenda Paper 15A. As noted in this paper, investors and creditors increasingly request information about matters that could affect the entity's long-term prospects, as well as about intangible resources and relationships, and about environmental, social, and governance matters. So in this paper, we provide an overview of the board's proposals intended to promote provision of information in management commentary about these interrelated matters. Paragraphs 7 to 11 explain the board's overall approach to developing guidance on these matters. The board acknowledged that information about them may be necessary to meet the objective of management commentary. However, in this project, the board is not seeking to identify specific matters that need to be explained or metrics that need to be provided in each management commentary. Instead, management commentary is intended to be a home for all material information about matters that fundamentally affect or could affect the entity's ability to create value and generate cash flows. And these matters can include matters that could affect the entity's long-term prospects, and in particular, intangible resources and relationships and ESG matters. So the board's principle-based approach is designed to allow preparers to focus on key matters that are specific to the entity and that would normally be monitored and managed by the entity's management because of their fundamental effect on the entity's ability to create value and generate cash flows. But this approach would also allow them to use other organizations' frameworks, standards, or guidance to help them identify those key matters and all material information about them. This approach is also flexible and would allow preparers to reassess that what information needs to be provided as the entity circumstances or investors and creditors' needs evolve. Draft guidance on information on matters of particular interest to investors and creditors is expected to be included throughout the exposure draft rather than in a single section. And this is because all these matters are interrelated and there is an overlap between them. For example, intangible resources and relationships and ESG matters would also be a subset of matters that can affect the entity's prospects over the long term. Also, these matters may affect various aspects of the entity and its operations, and so would need to be described throughout management commentary. The board's principle-based approach was largely supported by the board's consultative groups, although some suggested that guidance on intangible resources and relationships should be made more prominent. Now, if we look at the guidance itself, Table 1 provides an overview of draft guidance on information about matters that could fundamentally affect the entity's long-term prospects. And what this table shows is that this guidance would be provided throughout the exposure draft. It will be in the guidance on the objective of management commentary, in guidance on materiality, and in guidance on all areas of content. Next, paragraph 15 provides an overview of draft guidance specific to intangible resources and relationships. And here it is important to highlight guidance on resources and relationships that specifies that key resources and relationships that the entity depends on and that need to be discussed in management commentary can include intangible resources and relationships, including those not recognized in the entity's financial statements. And finally, if we move to ESG matters, here it is important to note that environmental matters, social matters, and governance matters can affect the entity differently. And so information that needs to be provided about them in management commentary would differ. In particular, the board is not proposing guidance on governance matters because governance requirements, as well as governance-related reporting, are typically set by local laws and may vary between jurisdictions. Nevertheless, information in management commentary may provide an insight into some governance matters, for example, through description of management commentary or information on how management monitors or manages key matters. Paragraph 19 provides an overview of draft guidance intended to promote information related to environmental and social matters. Firstly, it is guidance on resources and relationships because the entity's key resources can include natural resources and the entity's key relationships can be its relationships with its employees, customers, suppliers, as well as its wider relationships that the entity depends on. Guidance on external environment is important because key external trends and factors that could fundamentally affect the entity may include social and environmental factors and trends. And finally, the guidance on business model asks for information about wider consequences or impacts of the entity's operations, for example, on the natural environment, on particular groups of people, or on society at large. And this information would need to be provided if those impacts can fundamentally affect the entity's ability to create value and generate cash flows. And with this, I'd like to turn it over to you and ask if you have any comments or questions on this paper.
Nick?
Thanks, Hans. So I'm very supportive that we have a principles-based approach to the practice statement. And I think we're working towards a good document. I particularly like that we have coherence and, if not, interconnectivity between the various sections and also relating back to the financial statements. I think that's all very important. But I do worry that not addressing these particular issues around environmental, societal, unrecognized intangibles in a separate cross-cutting section, we may look back at that and regard that as a missed opportunity. And I particularly say that when I think about the audience for the practice statement. This isn't our normal audience. It's not an audience that's necessarily used to dealing with principle-based recommendations or requirements. And I think it would be helpful, it'd make the statement more accessible, particularly in respect to these issues where there is a notable focus from investors, that we could pull something together or seek to that address these collectively and worked out how these fitted into the management commentary overall. I think also there's some specifics we could address here or emphasize, such as the use of metrics, the interrelationship between societal issues and unrecognized intangibles. We described it at our conference that the management commentary statement could be a docking station for other disclosure frameworks. it's not immediately clear to me, looking what we have in terms of the, what we set out in terms of our principles in the separate sections, that that's immediately obvious. I just wonder whether we should at least explore the possibility, whether we can help to make the statement more accessible, particularly around these issues that I'm sure, we know investors are very interested in, and I'm sure a number of preparers are grappling with at the moment. Just to put that on the table. Thank you.
Yeah, I would like to echo what Nick just said. I think this is going to be a little bit too high level. Many companies are desperate to get some more guidance on how to deal with sustainability issues, etc. And I think they are now, it's all there, but at very high level principles. And I would also, if you have suggestions as to how to tackle this more specifically, cross-cutting these high principles, I think that would be very well received. Let me see who is next. I see the staff has suggestions to Nick's comments, which were just echoed by me. Perhaps this would be a good opportunity for you to say a few words about how you thought you could handle this. Otherwise, everybody might be just repeating himself. Julia?
Yes, thank you very much, Hans and Nick. So what we could do in response to those comments, given that ESG and intangibles is a cross-cutting issue, we could perhaps include an additional section in the document. Perhaps it can be an appendix, which would sort of provide a roadmap for preparers for how to use our guidance in tackling ESG matters long-term and intangibles in their management commentary. I think what's really important here that the guidance is there, but it's spread across all sections in the revised practice statement, and therefore it may not be visible enough. And also it may be difficult for a preparer to see all those aspects of guidance which are relevant to ESG, long-term and intangibles. So we have been thinking that including sort of an additional section that does not necessarily provide more guidance or more information, but which explains how and where in the practice statement this guidance is provided, will help preparers identify and provide that information. So that's what we had in mind. And I wonder whether Nick, for example, Johans and others think that it's a promising approach.
Nick, did you want to get back to that, or?
Yeah. I mean, I think it would be certainly. I would welcome that, and I think that would form a good framework. I'd say there may be some other specifics that we would that may be appropriate to fit in there. But yeah, I would definitely welcome something that is cross-cutting. Absolutely.
And I know there are hesitations about this, but would it at all be thinkable that we our management commentary is high level principles, and then there are lots of standards around that give particular kinds of that lead companies to give particular information. Would it at all be possible for us to suggest to companies where they might look for standards to provide particular information that is focused on financial materiality, or do you think that would be too dangerous or too risky? Is that something that you could think about as well?
We can certainly think about that in drafting. I wonder if Matt has some comments or thoughts on this particular suggestion.
Yes, if I may. So I think the one danger with your suggestion there, Hans, is that a lot of the guidance is focused purely on ESG matters. And as we've highlighted in this paper, the concern also lies with information on intangibles and business resilience. So I think we would have to manage the danger of producing something that was slightly one-sided and gave the wrong impression if we were to refer to specific examples of guidance.
Because basically we wouldn't have anything to refer to in terms of intangibles.
Exactly.
Is that what you're saying? Well, we can make that clear. I still think it might be useful, but also because a lot of people, they are not, it's not clear to them what the distinction is between the management commentary practice statement and all these standards that deliver, aim to deliver sustainability information.
I think we can certainly think about whether and how we can comment on how the revised practice statement and management commentary interact sort of with other reports and with other frameworks. We need to be careful with whether and how we make any specific references. And in addition to what Matt has said, there is also a consideration of what if other frameworks evolve and new frameworks emerge. So by being too specific, we risk to make the revised practice statement quite sort of more temporary.
But if it, you know, if you're going to say we are, the management commentary is basically a docking station to include information that it may be delivered by other standards, then at least I think you have to give some information about what is there. I know the five sustainability standard setters have recently sketched what their materiality approach is, what kind of information they give. You might just want to refer to that. You know, I don't know how prominently you would have to do that, but if you want to talk about the function of the management commentary as a docking station, you should tell people what is there that can be docked in. And without really expressing any preferences for certain standards, because that would be tricky. We don't know those standards very well. We cannot judge them one by one. People will be using them.
So your suggestion would be to consider illustrative references.
Yeah, well, you will have to find a way to do it, but that could be the way out. But you have to think about it. Otherwise, it's just too abstract.
In a relatively neutral way, by, for example, saying that if an entity determines that its investors need information about climate change, using specific climate disclosures, it's, you know, by another set of requirements could be used to satisfy those objectives, not refer to a specific one, but at least give the example of, you know, the type of links that would exist. Because I think that we want the we talk a lot about how this document's going to be picked up by people who don't usually read our requirements. I think one of the things that we can do to make it easiest for these people is to make it as sort of practical and, excuse the pun, tangible as possible in terms of what are you actually asking me to do? How do I actually do this in a practical way?
Okay, we can think about those. Yeah. Thank you.
Mary?
Thanks, Hans. I had a couple of specific comments and then an aspirational suggestion to the staff. The two specific things I want to flag is we talk at one point, and I understand why, about forward-looking information. I've been reminded a couple of times recently that that phrase has sometimes legal meanings or legal consequences in some jurisdictions, and either requirements for labeling something forward-looking or responsibilities that are associated with it. So, and I know in the situations in which it's been raised with me, we found, for example, that we can convey our point just as clearly talking about the need to the need to use projections of future cash flows. So just think about the terminology and whether it's necessary to use that. And a second point along those lines, and it relates to this docking stations, concept, docking station concept. If we keep talking broadly about the ability to work with other standard setters frameworks, I think we're just going to have to be clear about whether we think that extends to another body of accounting principles used to prepare the financial statement. So do we or do we not think that our management commentary, you can say I've done an IFRS practice statement management commentary when I have prepared the financial statements that accompany that management commentary on a basis other than IFRS standards. I think we should just be clear about that if we're talking about interaction with other standard, the flexibility to use this with the work of other standard setters. And then in terms of aspirational, I think, Yulia, I was interested in your idea of supplementing the information in the management commentary with educational material to, or some kind of supporting material that's not part of the standard itself but would be readily available, because I think that the longer the discussion is and the more that's in the document, the more it actually runs the risk of being misunderstood or sending different messages to different people. If you approach it saying, I think I might find the answer to my problem in here, you might say, yes, see, this is why it does say you should be discussing governance issues, or this is why it does, things that might be further from the stated objective we have from this project. So my aspirational advice to you, which I'm not illustrating well in my comment, is to be tight in the drafting and boring in the terminology. And I'm advocating being boring in the terminology, because the more we try to vary it to engage people, the more we create new words that are going to be the reference points for people making materiality judgments. So we talk about severely disrupting, fundamentally affecting, things are being key. And I think we have to think about whether we need all those different qualitative assessments or whether we can reduce it to something that's a smaller population that is consistently used, so that people don't have to say, oh, this is a different kind of assessment that I'm making. And while it might be a bit more boring to read, it saves a lot in terms of people with very different trainings and backgrounds trying to pick it up and apply it. So I think an example in this paper that was very helpful is paragraph 14 is a good example of how you tie something specifically back to the definition of material. And I think almost working with a copy of the objective for management commentary pinned above the computer that's being used to draft would be helpful, so that we keep referring consistently back to that objective. So that's kind of overall reactions to this.
Okay, Rika.
Thank you, Hans. I understand what Nick and Hans ask the staff to have more inclusion of the separate section, but I sit more close to the staff's recommendation. I mean, not recommendation, staff structure, the management commentary here in the paper. I think first of all, I consider the recent trend of the more companies start preparing a separate ESG type report and try to cover a broader range of the matter for a broader audience. So I think the management commentary's role now here is more critical to bridge the information in such a separate report with the information within the financial statement from the investor's perspective. So I think in order to create such a good law of bridging the information as a home for explanatory information in the financial statement, I think it's one way is how the staff articulate here, but I might consider another way is Nick and Hans suggested, because this is kind of the depending on the extent of the information included in ESG type report, they might include broader information or might be narrow information, not really meaningful to connect with the financial statement. So that is one point. Is another point is I think illustration and example will be very helpful. And I thought paragraph 19 include a good example. But when we include such an example within a practical statement, I hope the staff will be very carefully drafted about why those metrics are included within the within practical statement as an example, like employee retention rate. That will be monitored by many companies, and management consider that's a key, but that might not be really key from the perspective of the management commentary to pursue the objective. Maybe the manufacturing companies, it's quite important to monitor the employee workers' retention, because it's really connected to the productivity as well as the profitability. But that not might be a case for other industry. So that's a kind of the suggestion I think about based on this paper. Thank you.
Vika, I did not quite understand what you said about these ESG reports. So you see a tendency of companies publishing a separate ESG report, and I'm sure this does not just happen in Japan, but all over the world. And how should that then, in your eyes, relate to the management commentary? Were you suggesting that we include some guidance if you write an ESG report, distill from that ESG report that part of the information that is material to investors and put that in the management commentary? Is that what you were saying? I didn't quite follow it.
If the management considered certain information included the ESG report is also important for a user of the financial statement, and it's quite necessary for user of the financial statement understand that information from the management commentary's perspective, I thought that should be incorporated into management commentary. But it depending on the situation to fact extent of the information are included within the other separate information. So that's what I thought. There might be some duplication, but
yes.
Some people are only looking at the financial report as a standalone, standalone information to look at as an investor. So I think,
that's a good suggestion actually, also for the guidance. That might be a practical way of approaching it, because most companies of any size have experience with writing these ESG reports, and they will want to know, so how does that relate to the management commentary? And so I think we need some practical guidance there too.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Zach.
Yeah, so I'll maybe start with a quick question related to Rika's point, and then I had a comment as well. I think what would be useful for me is a clarification of whether we would still allow cross-reference to other materials to Rika's point. So if there was a more full discussion of ESG matters or intangible resources somewhere else, if that would be allowed in this portion of management commentary. That's one way of dealing with the issue of, say, this focus on financial materiality versus other users wanting additional information. And then on the comment, I think the ESG and intangibles information, I think, is a response to the demand for more long-term information, more long-term thinking from management teams, which is good. I think it's coming from users. I think it's coming from other preparers themselves. They want to be able to articulate those things. But it does beg the question of the management commentary structure, where we want to keep things as concise as possible. And we need to communicate in interim and annual reports updates on what's happening. But a lot of the information we're asking for is actually long-term thinking and long-term targets. And it might behoove us to think through structures that allow companies to lay out long-term matters like, what is our basic business strategy? And then not repeat that every semester or every year, but instead hold it somewhere else. Because one of the key user complaints we get is duplication of the same information over and over, where users end up not reading management commentary, but blacklining management commentary, which means they just look for the changes period over period and read what's changed. So if you were able to create structures and organization systems that allowed for the long-term thinking to lie one place, and then you simply provide updates on if the strategy has changed, what are our metrics towards achieving that strategy? That might be a different way of thinking of it, similar to Nick's idea of laying out all the ESG in one section, is you could have some of the long-term thoughts appear maybe by cross-reference, because they don't change much year to year, and simply provide the updates against those in the interim and annual statements.
Okay, thank you, Zach. Bruce.
Thanks, Hans. I guess it was just a comment on Paris 16 in the paper. We talk about there the fact that, and maybe it's also a bit of a question to the staff, we talk about the fact that some of the reviewers have commented on that we need to highlight or create more prominence around the intangibles, the resource and relationship section. I mean, I guess I was just surprised by that, because in my mind, I think we're setting out a framework. I mean, obviously, how it impacts each entity in their specific industry, in their specific country. You know, ESG could be more important to one than the other. I was just curious as to why you would want to give more prominence to the ones, to that section as opposed to the others, or why wouldn't leave that to management to make their determination on what they thought was more important.
Shall I answer that? Because
yes.
It came out because we had a couple of discussions, and in the same sort of stream of discussions, people were discussing research on intangible resources and relationships, including some of the suggestions that go much further than we would probably go, talking about measurements, possible measurement of intangibles, and so on. So it is mostly those people who would then join our sessions who would provide that view and say that we need to give more guidance on intangible, have it more prominently, because they can affect, they increasingly affect the entity's ability to create value more and more.
Okay. Jen Chao.
Thank you, Hans. I think most of the points has been made. So just a couple of things. First, I also think that it's necessary and worthwhile to address a little bit further on intangible resources and as well as ESG information. If you look at the information needs from user side, they do need this kind of information. And I think it's a really good opportunity to seek, at least to seek the views from stakeholders through this our exposure draft. If we did not mention and did not develop some kind of proposal, how can we seek the feedback from the stakeholder exactly? So I also think that it's a very good opportunity to seek the feedback, whatever proposal we have, but to include those two elements in our management commentary explore your draft? And secondly, how can we approach those two parts? I think the intangible resources and ESG information, they are slightly different. I hope that, I think Bruce also mentioned a little bit, intangible resources is a part of resources and relationships. So I hope that part could be addressed in the draft guidance, that the section of the resources and the relationships do not need to develop additional documents or additional sections or other areas to address that issue. Just give the other more more guidance in that section. For ESG part, I think there are a lot of cross cutting issue there, and I hope that if it's possible, it's better to have a separate section or separate additional guidance in place how to help preparers to disclose those ESG information. But finally, with regard to the cross-cutting issue, if those companies do disclose separate ESG reports, as Lika also mentioned, I think there are two issues. First, if some companies do disclose the ESG report, and then the company can make reference to that report, but the problem is that in many jurisdictions, maybe there are no legal requirements for the companies to disclose. So some companies disclose, sometimes companies do not disclose separate ESG report. And we are aware that some ESG information do have financial materiality feature. So I think those information should also need to be disclosed in management commentary. And another issue is that even some companies do disclose the ESG report separately. Maybe those companies do not disclose that report at the same time management commentary disclose. So how can management commentary make reference to that report if that report was disclosed later than management commentary? So I think we still need to think about this kind of thing. So the top priority is still try to address ESG information in our draft guidance, and then to think about how to make cross-reference if those companies do disclose separately ESG report, and also they disclose those information at the same time, and then the company can make cross-reference to those documents. So thank you.
Okay, thank you. Jen Chao, Françoise.
Yes, thank you. I was pleased to see this paper because I thought it was, and I read it as being a good check, in fact, that the way we had articulated the content of the management commentary was a good basis to make the appropriate links to all this supplementary information that we are discussing this morning. And like Rika said, I mean, I would wish that we keep the structure of the document as it is, because I think we have thought clearly of the main content. And so it's really interactions between those elements of contents and the ESG and other matters that that we want to make. Now, I would welcome having in the basis for conclusions, I mean, first of all, we have all throughout the document illustrative examples, and they can be, we can make sure that we have enough of those to illustrate that in the document. I would also welcome in the basis for conclusion that we show how all this interrelated, probably using some of this document. And I would also support, I mean, that as has been discussed earlier, that we see how we show how all this interrelates with reports and drafted in accordance with other standards. Thank you.
Thank you, Françoise. Tadeu?
Thank you, Hans. I remember one of the slides that we have for management commentary that it sits between financial statements and wide corporate reporting. I acknowledge the demand for ESG information, and I think that we are trying to incorporate this in this project. But at the same time, I think that we should keep the document between these two reporting and avoiding going too much towards a wider corporate reporting. Today, the document is already very comprehensive. It's just to think about bringing too much and changing what we are trying to achieve with the document. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Tadeu. Although I asked for a little bit more, I still agree with you, too. So I don't think the points of view are very far apart. Matt, did you want to respond to what Zach said earlier?
Yes, thank you, Hans. Sorry, belated response. Zach, you'd raised the point about standing data, and I just wanted to highlight the previous discussions we'd had around that, which essentially was that the view was that management commentary should present a complete picture, but it should also highlight changes to data. So that addresses your blacklining point. And also there is this, we've discussed facility within management commentary to cross-refer to information. So an entity might sort of use that facility to cross-refer to the standing data if it felt that was appropriate.
Okay. Thank you, Matt. And Nick, you wanted to come back in?
Thanks, Hans. Just to clarify two or three things. As Rika says, she's right that increasingly entities are producing separate ESG reports, and that's fine and good. That's for a wider group of stakeholders. Clearly, it's, I think, essential that if any of those items are material to the primary users of financial statements, those would also be reflected in the management commentary. I don't think what I'm suggesting, I think probably that Hans, you, I, and Tadilla aligned, is a move to wider corporate reporting. All I'm suggesting is trying to have a section that makes our framework more accessible, particularly around these issues. And finally, on intangibles, I actually see there's a very close relationship between the unrecognized intangibles and the S in ESG. So a good example would be health and safety. So you need to have a very good health and safety record as a license to operate as a miner, for instance. That would be part of your ESG considerations, but it's also part of your intangible assets as well, that you have that license. The same may be true around many issues to do with staff retention and motivation. Those would fit into the S of ESG, but they're also part of your intangible resources. And that's certainly one thing that I would hope to draw out in a cross-cutting section, that these interrelationships here do exist. Just a few clarifications. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. There was no decision to be made here, but I think the staff got some useful feedback. So I think we are now ready to go to the next paper, Yelena.
So the next paper is agenda paper 15B, and here we provide an initial assessment of the likely effects of implementing the board's proposals in this project. So the practice statement is non-mandatory, and entities will apply it either if it is mandated in their jurisdictions or if they choose to apply it voluntarily. And at the moment, we found only a small number of entities that apply the existing practice statement. So the effects analysis focuses not on how the proposals could affect those entities, but rather on how the proposals could include, could improve the quality of financial reporting. So first, the proposals are designed to deliver improvements in the three focus areas of the project. Firstly, the proposals highlight that management commentary needs to focus on key matters and on material information about those key matters, and draft guidance to help preparers identify those key matters and material information about them is provided throughout the exposure draft, as summarized in paragraph 14. Those proposals could help preparers exercise better judgment in making materiality assessments so that management commentaries focus more on key matters and provide material information about them specific to the entity. The second focus area of this project is promoting provision of information on interrelated matters of particular interest to investors and creditors that we've just discussed in Agenda Paper 15A. And as noted in that paper, the proposals are expected to lead to management commentary providing material information about all key matters that could fundamentally affect the entity's long-term prospects, about its key intangible resources and relationships, and about key ESG matters. We also expect that proposals will clarify the interaction between the practice statement and other organizations' framework standards and requirements. And here it's important to note two things. Firstly, the draft guidance explains that other knowledge of reporting requirements and guidance might help management identify key matters and determine which information about those matters is material. And the guidance would also allow entities to include in management commentary information required by local law or regulations that would not necessarily be considered material applying the board proposals. And this could be done if that information is provided in a way that does not obscure material information. The third focus area of the project is improving coherence of information in management commentary. And paragraph 22 summarizes draft guidance that is expected to improve coherence of information provided on each key matter throughout management commentary, as well as coherence between discussions of different key matters in management commentary, and coherence of information in management commentary with information in the entity's related financial statements and in other publicly available reports. So in addition to considering the focus areas, we considered other possible improvements to the quality of information in management commentary. We've heard that narrative reporting information often lacks characteristics of useful financial information set out in the conceptual framework. So the revised practice statement would not only retain the requirements for information in management commentary to have those characteristics, but also deliver those requirements in a simple language and accompanied by supporting guidance. Finally, because financial reports are increasingly used in electronic format, we looked at possible improvements to the quality of electronic reporting. We think that more specific proposals for the revised practice statement, and in particular detailed disclosure objective, could facilitate better electronic reporting by providing more specific IFRS taxonomy elements for management commentary. We also considered possible benefits of the board's proposals for local jurisdictions. Our research indicated that despite the limited level of adoption of the existing practice statement, it has been influential in the development of local narrative reporting requirements. Paragraph 31 to 34 explain that more structured guidance and clear disclosure objectives would provide a better basis for enforcement of the practice statement and providing external assurance on management commentary. We think that this, combined with likely improvements to the quality of reporting that I've just talked about, could encourage local regulators to either mandate the practice statement or to reflect the revised proposals in local requirements. As well as benefits, we considered the likely costs of proposals. So paragraph 35 to 38 discussed likely costs to preparers of implementing the proposals and of ongoing application. it is important to note that implementing the proposals and their ongoing application is unlikely to lead to significant costs related to producing information specifically for management commentary. And this is because information in management commentary is expected to be derived from information used by management in managing the business. The costs to prepares are more likely to relate to establishing and maintaining internal systems for selecting information for management commentary and determining how to present that information. And the extent of those costs would differ and would depend on the entity's current reporting system. The costs could be more significant for entities that currently do not prepare management commentary, but could be more limited for those preparers who already prepare management commentary or a similar report. Paragraph 39 discusses likely costs for investors and creditors of analyzing the resulting information. And here we expect that the proposals would save investors and creditors costs because the proposals are based on their information needs. In addition, as I just noted, the proposal is expected to improve the quality of electronic reporting, which could also save costs for investors and creditors. So to conclude, we think that the likely benefits of implementing and applying the revised practice statement would significantly outweigh the likely costs of implementing the proposals and their ongoing application. We also think that implementing the proposals would provide significantly more benefits than the existing practice statements. So with this, we'd like to ask for your comments and questions on the likely effects of the project proposals.
Thank you, Yelena. Sue.
Thanks, Yelena. And I agree with the overall assessment that the benefits outweigh the costs and with the general analysis that you've set out in the paper. I just had a few suggestions for the sort of the drafting of the final version of this. So while I completely am on board with the approach that the board is proposing, which is a principles-based approach that's not industry-specific and that relies on this idea of sort of docking and making use of more specific and detailed requirements and guidance when an entity identifies areas that are important for their investors to understand, I think we should perhaps be a little bit more neutral in the benefits and some of the sort of consequences of that approach. And the things that I think we need to think carefully about acknowledging are the fact that it's going to require really good quality application and thoughtful application and a really good understanding of materiality for somebody to pick up such a principles-based document and to get a good outcome. Now, they you know, people are perfectly capable of doing that, but it can be more time-consuming and difficult for a preparer to deal with a document like that than one that's a much more specific set of requirements. And I think we should acknowledge the quality of application that we'd be relying on to get the, you know, to have our dreams fulfilled with this document. I think the other thing that it would be good to sort of acknowledge a little bit more, even though I completely agree with where we've landed, is that one of the consequences of this approach, which relies on entities using our practice statement to identify areas of interest, if you like, but then thinking about using other regimes or their own ideas to work out how best to fulfill the disclosures that would be necessary, is that there would be less comparability for investors than if we were to establish more specific disclosure requirements, even industry-specific ones. Now, I completely agree with not doing that. I don't think that the IASB should do that, being a global standard setter that tends to do industry-neutral things. But I think we should more clearly acknowledge that there are some more comparability challenges for investors because of that approach. Now, I think, and that's fine, and I think one of the things that may, in fact, on balance, help people, but we should perhaps say it out loud, is that to the extent that in a particular industry or a particular jurisdiction, there are more specific requirements that are the ones that entities tend to choose to follow, we may indirectly still get comparability, but it's not being achieved directly from our regime. But I think we should acknowledge that. So it's really just making sure that we're not so positive on the great things that we sort of lacking in neutrality in terms of acknowledging some of these other consequences and considerations. And one of the things that it might help us with on this point that Hans and Nick were sort of touching on earlier on is that if people pick it up and say, actually, it would be better if there was a bit more specificity, so they did want to sort of encourage us to choose particular regimes that we should, in fact, sort of hard code a little bit more in, that at least prompts them to think about that if we've acknowledged some of the comparability questions. So it might facilitate the consultation process as well. But not taking away from the fact that I do agree with the overall assessment, it's just being a little bit more neutral in tone sometimes in a couple of places.
Rika.
Oh, thank you, Hans. And I agree with Sue's comment about the tone of our statement about the benefits and cost might be borne by preparers and other stakeholders. So because of that, I really think it's important for us to get feedback from a broader group of stakeholders, because as paper said that not many jurisdictions fully comply with a practice statement, and that are not required, not in many jurisdictions. But I think while we are preparing drafting and our board discussion, staff and board members communicated closely with the regulators and the standard setter, those are preparing their own guidance or requirement of management commentary. So, and also the that consultation as well as the final development will be influence their future development of the guidance and the requirement in each jurisdiction. So I think it's really good to give more prominence what staff explain about 34 to get get more stakeholders engagement to receiving good feedback.
Thank you, Rika. Tadeo?
Thank you, Hans. In paragraph 29, the paper states that providing more structured and more granular guidance would facilitate better electronic reporting by providing more specific IFRS taxonomy elements for management commentary. I fully agree with that. We have been going through this all these taxonomy updates, and we can see how important is the way that the disclosure requirements, that's not the case here, but the guidance itself is structured. And I believe that developing the practice statement, keep an eye on the taxonomy perspective, helps document itself to be structured. And as mentioned in paragraph 39, it will likely benefit investors and creditors in their analysis, together with the fact that makes feasible information be subject to a level of external assurance.
Okay. Anne?
I also wanted to comment on taxonomy, and Tadeo's made those good points. I do think we have to give resources into developing the taxonomy that this would be part of the management commentary practice statement. And I'm also wondering if by doing that, that can be one of the ways that we try and promote the adoption of the management commentary practice statement, because I think we really want to get wider impact of this statement, all the work that we've put in. It would be great to see it having a much more effect than last time round. And I agree with Tadeo's points that we know that the CFA Institute and the Council of Institutional Investors have been lobbying the SEC to make tagging mandatory for the MD&A in the US. So this is a strong indication that they believe investors would make use of the tagged information. So I think it is worth our resources going into that. Thank you.
Okay, any further comments? No, okay, then we go to the final paper, which is a due process paper. Is Nicolette going to introduce that? Okay.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Hans, and good morning, everyone. So Agenda Paper 15C addresses the due process steps undertaken for the publication of the exposure draft of the revised practice statement and requests permission to begin balloting. A summary of the background for the project focusing on the board's due process decisions to date is included in paragraphs 4 to 6 of the paper. Paragraphs 7 to 10 discuss why the board's initial position that an exposure draft should be published remains appropriate based on the requirements in the revised due process handbook published in August 2020. This is because the problem is well defined and the proposals are sufficiently detailed for the publication of exposure drafts. Secondly, that investor demand for the project remains strong. Thirdly, investors support the overall direction. And lastly, it would be more effective to test the drafting in an exposure draft than in a discussion paper. Therefore, we have considered all the relevant due process steps for and matters associated with publishing an exposure draft. First, we discussed the effective date of and the transition to the revised practice statement. We recommend that the revised practice statement becomes effective for annual reporting periods beginning on or after the date of its publication. This would allow at least a year for companies to prepare their management commentary applying the revised practice statement. That time would allow them to create or adjust internal systems and control procedures, as well as to consider what information is material and how to present that information in management commentary in a way that is helpful to investors and creditors. Once the revised practice statement becomes effective, this would mean that the existing practice statement would no longer be applicable. We also recommend that early application is permitted so that preparers can apply the revised practice statement as soon as possible to better meet investors' and creditors' information needs. We have not identified any disadvantages to investors and creditors that could result from early application of the revised practice statement. We have also not set out any specific transition provisions for the revised practice statement. This is because no new information would need to be produced specifically for management commentary. Instead, information in management commentary is expected to be derived from information used by management in managing the business. I would like to now draw your attention to question 1 on page 6 of the paper and ask if you agree with our recommendations regarding the effective date and early application summarized in paragraphs 14 and 15 of the paper.
Okay. So.
I think I was the first one.
Sue, yeah? Okay.
I think, yeah. Nicolette, so I agree with your punchline in terms of where you get in terms of allowing early application and asking people to use the new practice statement effective some period after its publication date to allow them time to adjust if they need to from what they're doing today. So I agree with where you're landing. I just think we need to look at the wording, because I think the wording of using effective dates and things like that is more what we use in our standards, where the requirements are requirements, as opposed to the practice statement where people can choose to use them. So I think the wording that we should look at should be more along the lines of what we've used traditionally in the practice statements in the past. So I think my suggestion would be something along the lines, which gets you to the same outcome, but something along the lines of saying that the revised management commentary practice statement is available from its publication date, which is what we usually say. It's available as soon as we publish it. So if you want to apply it early, you can. And then to say that the old management commentary practice statement is withdrawn and therefore no longer available from whatever this effective date would be. So it's making it clear that it's an availability thing, which is the wording we've used, I think, in the past for both of our practice statements to sort of reflect their nature, which is they're sort of an opportunity as opposed to an obligation. So same outcome, but just suggesting words which are more aligned with what we've used in the past.
Yeah, I agree with Sue. I wonder if you could even forbid early application of a totally voluntary standard. Rika?
I have nothing to add to Sue and your comment.
Okay. Thank you. That's how we like to hear it. Tadeo? You're in the same camp, right?
Yes, I am. I think that we are picking the old list. Yes, I have no comment. I think I agree.
I think I'm the only one with my hand up for this one. That's the old list. So it's Françoise next.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, sometimes you get confused. Françoise.
Yeah, I'm reacting to just the comments made by Sue and the fact that. It's not an IFRS standard. So the jurisdictions that today have adopted IFRS, it's not part of the mandatory requirements within the framework of jurisdiction having adopted to date. Now, a jurisdiction that adopts that practice statement would, as we say, the content of the statement once adopted by a jurisdiction would become requirements. So why should the language be different?
Really, all I'm suggesting, Françoise, is we've had practice statements in the past, two practice statements in the past, and we've got a particular form of words we've used. So I'm just suggesting that we should be using a form of words similar to what we have in the past, because I didn't think we were in a different situation. That's really all I was saying, because at the moment both of the practice statements said they were available from their publication date, and we're doing the same thing in the revisions that we're doing at the moment to the materiality practice statement. So I was just trying to align it with our current wording rather than create something novel, because I wasn't aware of a need to. That was all.
Okay. Nicolette, please go to the last questions.
Okay, thank you, Hans. So paragraph 16-24 summarise the due process steps undertaken in the project in accordance with the due process handbook. A summary of the due process steps is included in Appendix A, and a list of public meetings of the board and its consultative group is included in Appendix B. An outstanding due process step is setting a comment period for the exposure draft. Based on our initial analysis in paragraphs 25 to 27, we do not think that a comment period of less than 120 days is necessary because the board is proposing a comprehensive revision of the practice statement. We expect to ask the board for a decision on the length of the comment letter period in early 2021, but welcome any initial comments now. Finally, paragraphs 28 to 29 discuss the required due process steps taken to date for the publication of the exposure draft, and that those have either been completed or will be completed before the publication of the exposure draft. In line with the relevant due process requirements, we are asking for the board's permission to begin balloting the exposure draft. Now, I would like to draw your attention to questions 2 to 4 on page 9 of the paper and ask, first, does the board have any comments about the comment period?
No comments on the comment period.
Hans, can we go back and vote on question 1 just to make sure that the board agrees with the punchline, which is that the early application is permitted and that the revised.
Sorry, not all about that. Yeah. Okay. Sorry. Do we agree with question 1? So does the board have any comments about the comment period? That is not the case. Permission to ballot.
Yes. So can I just ask the question? So is the board satisfied that it has complied with the applicable due process steps and that it should begin the balloting process for the exposure draft?
Nick's got a question.
Nick, yes?
Yeah, so just to clarify. Yeah, this question. So just to clarify, obviously we had a discussion on paper 15A, which staff are going to go away and think about our comments in relation to ESG and intangibles. I just want to check that permission to balance doesn't preclude any staff work on those issues. Okay, thank you. I can see Julia nodding. Thank you.
All right, with that clarification, can we give the staff permission to ballot?
13.
Okay. Can I see if there are any dissents coming up? That is not the case. So that completes our discussions for this month. I thank the staff for the hard work. And we'll see each other again next month. Thank you.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks all. Take care.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.